On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to Thursday. Yes, Thursday. Welcome to the last day. Well, I mean, you've been here all day long, but well, welcome to the last day of Friday on the Horn. Does that work a little better? Yeah, I thought so too. Bit presumptuous to welcome you to a day that you're already, oh goodness me, 18 hours into. Hi, this is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, where you'll find the Listen Live button. But if that doesn't work for you, you can always use a streaming mobile device like, say, your smartphone with things like the TuneIn app and the Stitcher app. Then, of course, there are other websites like Streama.com, Dar.fm, Roku devices have us listed. There are several others that I never seem to remember to put on the list. And, of course, you can get the podcast at iTunes, or you can get the podcast address simply by grabbing the feed address at the subdomain for Head On with Bob Kincaid over at whiteroadsociety.org. Obviously, I'm Bob Kincaid. And it is, in fact, Thorn in the Side Thursday. And I think we're going to stay busy tonight. Pretty sure. You ever been to the chat room? It'd be a wonderful night to go wandering by there. Yes, I did throw the third switch. We are streaming merrily along. And now pop by the chat room if you like it. It's free. It's easy. Just pick yourself out a screen name and a password. Jump right in. There's a zany real-time conversation that follows along at the same time as the program that enhances the entire experience, shall we say. It is, in fact, the last day of February. The sword of Damocles hangs over the nation's head because of a vicious political party that is actually trying to tear this country apart. And whether they succeed, well, we'll just kind of have to wait and see, won't we? It is Sequester Eve. Sounds like a product. Sounds like what juvenile delinquent in the sky did to the first woman folk when he caught her enjoying the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Doesn't that tell you something? That God would be mad about you knowing the difference between good and evil? Yeah. We'll sort that one out at some point. No, we won't. The Horn is, of course, listener-supported. And we find ourselves trying to wrap up what has been a very harrowing February. And we are within striking distance. We're about $200 away from finishing the month in the black. And we've got tonight to raise it. So thank you very kindly for any help we get. We got some help from our buddy Philip, from whom we hear from time to time. And he dropped a note along with his kind contribution. He said, I've made a small donation because I finally can. But you know, that's not where it's going to end, because Philip is far too brilliant a correspondent to just let it hang there. He says, here's the good news. After 14 months, the processing interval is thanks to the budgetary cuts that have decimated the ranks of their retirement adjudicators at a time when the federal government is laying off and offering early outs. After 14 months, the Office of Personnel Management has approved my disability, as you will read below in my retirement announcement to friends. I'd heard horror stories from friends on disability and cautionary advice like that I got from Jim some months back, saying the Office of Personnel Management could be prickly to deal with, and that I needed to fight with as much medical documentation as I could. But, says Philip, I was approved on the first shot, even though I ran out of money early last year to buy the goats and bullocks for the sacrificial offerings to the gods and goddesses. Philip continues and says, so we'll be current on the rent and make good with the landlord by the time my checks start coming in, and I'll have that delightful perk called regular income again, and more importantly, become a full-time member of the 47%. In the meantime, my latest wistful thought is that all members of Congress live off the same income as we did for only 1 year, with the provision that it is the only income to which they have access. Again, we're a few thousand above the poverty line for a family of our size, and we still don't have a car. But the living was bleak, and eating at Taco Bell was beyond the budget. I may be wrong, says Philip, but I suspect that a few minds just might change if they had to live as we and others worse off when they realize that the apocryphal stories that Ronald Reagan and his ilk relished about living large on federal monies are pure and simple bullshit, and life on the margin in this God-blessed capitalist paradise in which the word exceptionalism is so sorely misunderstood just ain't no fun at all. Philip says, I must digress. Do, please. I know you refer to the Horn as a family, and I must strongly disagree. Uh-oh. When I compare the Horn with my Irish-American family and relatives, it is remarkably deficient in insults, fighting, and feuds. If you must use the moniker family, then I will expect to hear at least every now and then, y'all paying attention, you're responsible for this, not necessarily me. I will expect to hear at least every now and then nonsensical bickering, pettiness, and other attributes of that warm and loving entity known as the post-famine Irish family. Think of the House of Representatives as an extended family, not the folks who listen to the Horn, who are far too respectful and decent towards one another. But despite my discomfort, I am willing to endure all that civility and camaraderie nightly, because the show is so damned interesting, and I enjoy a righteous tirade, otherwise known as a filibobster, from time to time, from the host who resides in my neighboring state and describes himself as a hillbilly with a law degree, despite this being an era in which the only laws that matter to most are the Second Amendment, the alleged laws of creationism, the laws of that huge entitlement known as the free market, and those that give incentives to oil and coal companies rather than indolent louts like me. Hell, to celebrate my lassitude and shiftlessness, we may go out and buy a couple of Cadillacs this weekend just so the family can travel that renowned poverty style that Republicans resent so much. In all seriousness, Bob, I wish the donation could be much more. The donations will be more timely once we get back on our feet financially after 5 very difficult years of decreased income, during which my mixed stubbornness caused me to ignore the doctor's admonitions and continue working rather than be an indolent parasite sucking at the public teat and making the likes of Mitt Romney turn even whiter with rage. Oh, that's quality. That's just quality. I got to respond to that, though. Philip, everything is appreciated, and that yours tremendously so. So, don't get in a hurry. Do what needs doing. Priorities here. Philip continues, I can now disclose that I worked for the IRS, as you no doubt suspected, an agency whose budget has been repeatedly cut over the past decade, because who needs revenue when political hay is being made at the Democrats' expense out of a Bush administration manufactured deficit? I finally applied for disability because the lesson of the past 30 years has finally sunk in. The real money's to be made in living off the collective investment of my country folk, and me in my pension, and not in continuing to foolishly labor to earn my wages. If only I had learned this 30 years ago, I might be a successful Republican, albeit an unsuccessful human being now. But, alas, ethics, morality, and pig-headedness kicked in, and I labored on long after my boss informed me that I was killing myself. Now that I've been bereft of my Catholic upbringing for more than 44 years, and having learned Republican economic theory, I no longer see the need for another poverty-stricken martyr whose portrait on relics or relics might be compelled to gaze on the corrupt doings of the Vatican. Ratzinger and I exiting at the same time, who'd have thunk it? Of course, my departure is less ceremonial, and I have no secret report, but you can't always get what you want, even if you get what you need. Damned if I didn't run almost the full gamut of a career. I had only 10 months until I reached my 30 years for full retirement, but no matter, I have bigger things to worry about now, such as whether Brother Albert airmails pizza to newly financially viable retirees. I know that as a lapsed Baptist, you too understand illogical guilt, so you'll appreciate that despite your assurances that those who can't afford to give shouldn't, I can now breathe a huge sigh of relief that I've been able to make even a small contribution again. The relief is so palpable I may buy some seeds and start planting white roses in the spring. Trust me, Bob, in these difficult times when there are so many worthy causes, choosing to whom to donate was not an easy decision. Because the Harry Reid Spina Bifida Fund seemed as compelling and worthwhile as a cause as the horn until I realized redeeming his spine is beyond hopeless. Ooh! See, it just goes in. It's surgical when Philip does this stuff. My best wishes to you, Agnes the Horn Commune. It will take some time for me to join you in calling it family. If Bill O'Reilly, Ann Coulter, Sean Hannity, Paul Ryan, and others who disgrace the memories of Bobby and Ted Kennedy, the Berrigan brothers, and Michael Harrington were members of your extended clan, you'd better understand my trepidation at using the term family. Then there's Uncle Leo and his participation in making Sacco and Vanzetti part of my legacy. So, commune it is, at least for now. And you know what? I will. I will try to, I will try to use that word commune from time to time. Just to keep Philip from feeling overly queasy at present circumstance and, well, family. In the chat room, Philip, Texas Betsy said she loves your letter. Jim writes in to Philip and says, congrats on the OPM decisions. Be well. Barnes & Noble, meanwhile, has sent me a spam asking what I would do with $50. Really? Do I have to explain? No, there really is a... and then this from Dr. John. Regarding Philip's email, Dr. John says, I'm so pleased to hear this. The only thing better than a smart and sharp Philip missive is a smart and sharp Philip missive that includes good news for him and his commune. Indeed. Thank you, Dr. John. I want to go back because, and this is not snobbery, okay? I don't sit around talking about, I don't make legal issues a central focus of this program, and I don't beat on the fact that I had a cup of coffee with Prosser and Keaton on torts. But you spend 3 years in a program like that, and it kind of rearranges the way your brain fires. And every now and then you'll just see one of these naughty, not N-A-U-G-H-T-Y. No, when Fat Tony Scalia gets that way, he has to whip himself with barbed wire and put on his official Thomas More ass hat and his Thomas More official hair shirt. Bad justice, bad. Oh, but it was so good. Oh, it itches deliciously. No, naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, naughty. Every now and then, even when you're trying not to do it, your mind will sort of fetch up on a naughty little problem and not let go. And that's kind of where I've been for the last 24 hours or so. You know what that filthy freak Scalia said yesterday. That the Voting Rights Act amounts to a racial entitlement that no amount of conscience could overcome, such that a member of Congress would never have the courage to vote against it, even though it result in the oppression of the several sovereign states over which Section 5 assumes jurisdiction. A racial entitlement. In particular, there was a line about, and this again from the constitutional originalist, the guy who says that his constitution is, and I quote from his public appearances, dead, 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 dead. He sounds like some sort of smarmy-ass bad guy from the original stuff. I'm sorry, James Kirk, it is dead, 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 dead. Right? Maybe the one with the high velvet-collared Nehru jacket, whichever episode that was. But he says that. He says the Constitution is immutable and dead, that it is not capable of changing with social mores. Understanding that, of course, that would mean that, as I described from Professor Keith Lilly's example, the classroom example, that means most of us don't vote. We're second-class citizens. That means a significant portion of the Horn Commune ain't even citizens. More than half. Let that sink in. But that is not the knotty problem. The knotty problem is one of language. And my taking off point is from this paragraph of that rotten old bastard's remarks. Jesus! You want proof that we have a dysfunctional government? The fact that we can't impeach his ass right off the court for remarks like this. This isn't philosophy, you see. This is hate. This is confirmation of everything that we ever thought the right wing secretly talks about, and now he's, you know, out of the conserva closet. And at this point, I'm pretty sure he's been fitted for his exalted dweeble clan robes. This is the language. Complaining about the Senate not voting against the Voting Rights Act, which most of us would like to chalk up to perhaps just a soupçon of enlightenment? I know, it's the Senate. I'm not going to get all misty-eyed. But complaining about the fact that no one in the Senate has the courage to vote against the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, he cites, among other things, the Sanhedrin. Really, the Sanhedrin, with the claim that where did it go? But that's not the knotty problem either. The Israeli Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, used to have a rule that if the death penalty was pronounced unanimously, it was invalid because there must be something wrong there. He said that some time back, Scalia did. And so since the Voting Rights Act was unanimously passed a few years back, Not a single vote against it in the last reauthorization. Fat Tony, by processes I will certainly not call intellectual, though he fancies himself one, by some process largely inscrutable to people of conscience, Fat Tony drew an analogy between the Voting Rights Act's reauthorization on a unanimous basis and a unanimous decision to execute a human being. Now, if you just let that rattle around for a few minutes, you'll begin to be probably as troubled as I have been by all of this. A law that mandates federal government scrutiny of certain jurisdictions with a history of abusing the civil rights of a significant portion of the American population stands on the same footing with Fat Tony Scalia as a unanimous decision to execute a human being. That in itself will keep you busy. Oh, it's Sanhedrin. Well, see, that's what you get when you grow up in the Baptist church being taught Hebrew words by Alabama ladies. That Sanhedrin, that's just awful. Sanhedrin. Cousin of Tippy Hedren. No. But after that's rattled around a little while, and once you've become a little more troubled by it, you will get around to, well, this is the language relating to that unanimous authorization, reauthorization in the Senate. Fat Tony said, "I don't think," no, he doesn't, "I don't think," and this is where he should use the word believe, because there's no thinking involved here, "I don't think there is anything to be gained by any senator to vote against continuation of this act. And I am fairly confident it will be reenacted in perpetuity," and there's a problem with this, unless a court can say it does not comport with the Constitution. You have to show, when you are treating different states differently, that there's a good reason for it. I'd say that showing was made 50 years ago. That showing was made in blood. That showing was made in Mississippi and Alabama. It was made in Tennessee and North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia. That showing was made. And there is no evidence to suggest, you know, for instance, when one of Alabama's members of the Senate has a history of having said, having once advised a young man of color who had come to work in the U.S. Attorney's office to be careful how he spoke to the white women, and referring to him as boy. Yeah, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions LaHood actually did that. But buried within that language is some really, really scary stuff. Because you have to understand Scalia's background as a constitutional so-called originalist, as we've discussed, and his willingness to declare Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, unconstitutional. This is a constitution which is changeless, he says, immutable. Let it settle in. And so, if one declares the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act to be unconstitutional, one is declaring it can't just become unconstitutional. Because the Constitution is immutable. If it was constitutional when it was passed and has been reauthorized time after time, then it remains constitutional. The only way to strike it down as unconstitutional is to suggest that it was unconstitutional in the moment of its passage. Which then suggests that keeping vast percentages of the American public have been voting improperly all along. And we know, of course, that if you were to pump a loading dose of sodium pentothal or some such, maybe a little ecstasy, or could be, because it is frightening in its implications. The principle of judicial review was first enunciated by Chief Justice John Marshall in Marbury versus Madison. And it sets forth the Constitution as the supreme law of the land and says that the Supreme Court will be the final arbiter of what the Constitution says, what it means, and determining the relationships between statute and Constitution. And that any statute found repugnant to the Constitution has to go. So now that we've got those few little items in our intellectual stewpot, we begin to see the world that Fat Tony Scalia wants to live in. And it is, in fact, a terrifying world. It's a world where the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, every effort to expand freedom for every American are repugnant. Because, again, I reiterate, if the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional now, it was unconstitutional. And that is terrifying. Yes, by the way, I know that the stream went down for a minute. That's some fine interweb we've got, but then again, it's snowing outside, so Lord only knows what's happening to our tubes. We should be back up. Let me take care of a couple of... And thanks, by the way, for letting me know when these things happen. You know, I wonder why it is so difficult to get decent internet out here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by God, Virginia. Don't know, but it sure is. I'm trying to envision a United States. Call it a United States of Scalia. If the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional, one could argue that a number of other things are as well, not just the Civil Rights Act. Would he like to strike down the holdings of Brown versus Board of Education? Sure, damned right he would. And because the so-called swing vote, the deciding vote in this case, will likely be precious Anthony Kennedy, well, I don't hold out a lot of hope for the Voting Rights Act. It will probably, the decision striking it down, Section 5, the decision that will strike it down will probably include the same sort of pathetic legal jurisprudential jabberwocky that one can most easily find by going and reading Bush v. Gore. But remember, please, that if it is unconstitutional in 2013, it was unconstitutional when it was passed. And taking it down will open a disenfranchisement floodgate. And the sun will shine bright on somebody's old Kentucky home. And old times in Dixie will not be forgotten. The man who claims that he despises judicial activism will have done about the single most judicially activist thing imaginable, stepping in to invalidate a portion of a statute that was, in fact, unanimously passed by the Senate of the United States of America. Because Scalia has declared that treating states that differently, that treated other its own citizens differently, is a concern that is not the kind of question you can leave to Congress. When before he's wanted to leave everything to Congress. As noted last night, even the Virginia senators. They have no interest in voting against this. Even the Virginia senators. As if filthy old Harry Byrd was still toddling up and down amongst the desks of the world's most exclusive country club. Scalia saying, even the name of it is wonderful, the Voting Rights Act. Who's going to vote against that in the future? What business is it of yours, Tony? You're the bench, remember? You want to vote against the Voting Rights Act? Take them damn robes off, get you some signs printed up, and some bumper stickers, and some emery boards, and some funeral home fans, and get out there on the hustings and campaign, you dirty old son of a bitch, and get yourself elected to something. And then you can wait around in the House or the Senate, and you can scream, no, hell no, states' rights forever, because I'm sure there is some district somewhere in the old Confederacy that would be thrilled to have you be its representing. South Carolina, as they say, is in the House. Jesus. There really is a disturbing fascist streak alive and well in this country. Clayton, the militant sociologist, asking, Bob, I wonder if Tony's father told him how Italians were treated 100 years ago, say. Interesting contemplation. Clayton is the militant Appalachian sociologist. Hear. You would think he would just about have to have. But Fat Tony's father was a real live, no kidding, fascist. You know, had the secret decoder ring and the certificate suitable for framing from the fascist party of Mussolini's Italy. And it wouldn't bother Fat Tony how his fellow Italians were treated 100-125 years ago. Not in the least. Because he would simply say that power needed to be seized. Because that is how fascists operate. Elections to a fascist are for sissies. During the arguments, a question was asked of the government's counsel, Sir, do you believe that Southerners are more racist than other citizens of the rest of the country? To which the poor fella had to sputter, I don't know why not? No. And of course, it is a correct statement. Racism in the South was merely more institutionalized and more out and visible. It was not the iron hand in the velvet glove that it was in other places. But it is because of that overtness that things like Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act exist. But no, it is all over the country. And it would seem that everything is open season for the racists. Take as a case in point, and this is a visual reference, but Dr. John reminded me of this and sent along an article. I'd seen it earlier in the day as well. Take the cover of Bloomberg Business Week. It is supposedly an article about recoveries, pre-existing and ongoing dangers within the housing market. The fact that some of the things that led to the crash are alive and well. This Bloomberg Businessweek cover is shocking, to say the very least. It portrays a pink house and has a cutaway circle showing four rooms. The windows of the house are open. The attic is open. The chimney, well, and all the windows have money spilling out of them, and it's fairly spewing out of the chimney. Even the outside water faucet has money coming out of it. Okay, so far. The title depicted on the cover of the magazine is The Great American Housing Rebound. Flips, no-look bids, 300% returns. What could possibly go wrong? Bloomberg Businessweek asks. Well, and they answered their own question, because within the cutaway of that magazine cover are four obviously depicted African-American people swimming in money, clutching fistfuls of cash. There is everything in this cartoon depiction of African-American people. Every stereotype is on display except the watermelon. And if you play Where's Waldo with the damn thing, I imagine you'll find that too. Big lips, big butts, busty, and the lone obvious male. With a pencil-thin mustache and gassed-back hair, literally swimming in money. And lo and behold, we're back to it again. All that... Yes on one and no to three, two, Betsy, and none of that, not really, no, sorta. You can see it, the cover is reproduced at babble.com. Wow, mind-blowingly racist Bloomberg Businessweek cover. This is the 21st century version of the welfare queen in her Cadillac going to pick up her welfare. You know, the implication being that somehow in order to live in a ramshackle house, persons of color must certainly be gaming the system. Funny. There's no depiction in this cartoon. No depiction of, say, the Monopoly guy whistling his way to the bank with fistfuls of your money in the form of a bailout. None whatsoever. On the other hand, however, thankfully, the decision of the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to send Elizabeth Warren to the Senate is already paying dividends. There was a hearing had featuring none other than Fed Chairman, or as I like to call him, unindicted co-conspirator, Ben Bernanke, in which Elizabeth Warren asked a question that really I think a lot of us have been asking, and she actually, well, almost got an answer. Almost.
Investors believe, with too big to fail out there, that it's safer to put your money into the big banks and not the little banks, in effect creating an insurance policy for the big banks, that the government is creating this insurance policy, not there for the small banks. And now some economists, including an economist at the IMF, has started to document exactly how much that subsidy is worth. Last week, Bloomberg did the math on it and came up with the number $83 billion.
Now, hold on a minute. Bloomberg did that? Bloomberg News? The same people who produced Bloomberg Business Week? $83 billion, an $83 billion insurance policy that we, the people of the United States, have been forced to write for giant banks that have gamed the system, scammed the system, ripped us off, and then given themselves bonuses with? Who caused the housing crisis in the first place and were paying them to do it? Bloomberg figured that out and then put out a magazine cover that shows caricaturized, cartoonized African Americans wallowing in cash. Are they arguing that... No, the argument's not there that the bankers are African, are cartoon-rendered African Americans. No. It's the same old BS... of blaming innocent victims for the excesses of thieves. Let's get back to Senator Warren.
That the big banks get in what is essentially a free insurance policy. They borrow cheaper than the small banks do. So I understand that we're all trying to get to the end of too big to fail. Mm-hmm. But my question, Mr. Chairman, is until we do, should those biggest financial institutions be repaying the American taxpayer that $83 billion subsidy that they're getting?
Well, the subsidy is coming because of market expectations that the government would bail out these firms if they failed. Those expectations are incorrect. We have an orderly liquidation authority. And even in the crisis, in the cases of AIG, for example, we wiped out the shareholders.
Excuse me, though, Mr. Chairman. You did not wipe out the shareholders of the largest financial institutions, did you, the big banks?
Because we didn't have the tools. Now we could.
Well,
have the tools.
$83 billion says that whatever you're saying, Mr. Chairman, $83 billion says that there really will be a bailout for the largest financial institutions if they fail.
No, that's the expectation of markets, but that doesn't mean that we have to do it. I think we have to do is solve the problem, Senator. I think we are really in agreement on this. Too big to fail is not absolute. There are spreads. Their credit default swaps say there is some probability of failure.
Wait a minute. Too big to fail thus far has proven to be an absolute, has it not? And the market generally gets what the market expects. Because, you see, the market, the mysterious, invisible market, expects in one hand and holds a gun to the head of the American people in the other. So considering how fantastically wrong Ben Bernanke and his predecessor, Alan Misrand, may I please suck your toes, Greenspan, have been, is there any reason to believe this mishmash of BS that he's trying to put over on a rather brilliant woman? Let's go back and listen to it again.
The tools.
$83 billion says that whatever you're saying, Mr. Chairman, $83 billion says that there really will be a bailout for the largest financial institutions if they fail.
No, that's the expectation of markets, but that doesn't mean that we have to do it. I think we have to do is solve the problem, Senator. I think we are really in agreement on this. Too big to fail is not absolute. There are spreads. Their credit default swaps say there is some probability of failure.
Before we get to the part, this is Sequester Eve. If the sequester kicks in as we expect it to, we understand that there will be some granny starving going on. Millions of dollars worth of granny starving. It will make the for-profit media absolutely pink with joy. We know, for instance, well, here in almost level West by God, Virginia, we know that our primary airport, Yeager, named after Chuck Yeager, we know that their air traffic controllers on the midnight shift will be furloughed. So between the hours of, say, midnight and 8 a.m., the air traffic controllers who watch the skies over central West Virginia ain't gonna be there. You got a problem? You got a mid-air emergency you need to put down at Yeager at 2 a.m.? Good luck, Sparky. You're on your own. Not you, Sparky. Yeah, just give it a little wag of the wing and hope you're coming in into the wind and not with it. Flaps, no flaps. Yeah, you know, I don't need no stinking flaps. So we know what will happen with some of what will happen with the sequester. But one wonders if, by some off chance, with some 700,000 jobs being destroyed, if by some odd chance the banking industry, the really big banks, the too big to fail banks, the ones that control literally the assets of half the economy of the United States, being the sum of somewhere around $9 trillion. If during all of this they somehow decide to point their claws skyward from their backs, their bellies up, as it were, with the sequestration in force, will we be able to find money to pay off on that $83 billion insurance policy? What do you think? Would you buy a used car from Ben Bernanke? Me neither.
Moody's and others have downgraded these firms. They've taken down some of their government support ratings, as you know. But we have a lot more to do, I agree. And I think that's a good debate to have. But we're in complete agreement that we need to stop big to fail.
But I don't understand. It is working like an insurance policy. Ordinary folks pay for homeowners insurance. Ordinary folks pay for car insurance. And these big financial institutions are getting cheaper borrowing to the tune of $83 billion in a single year, simply because people believe that the government would step in and bail them out. And I'm just saying, if they're getting it, why shouldn't they pay for it?
I think we should get rid of it.
He thinks. I wouldn't be surprised if I found out that Ben Bernanke woke up this morning with a horse's head in his bed. Because we're not talking about the building and loan from It's a Wonderful Life. We're talking about Pottersville. There's another one of those movie references. We're talking about billionaires who do not ask, but rather tell the government of we, the people, what to do. Tell. And they do it by describing the dire consequences of not carrying them and their excesses. The term, by the way, for the Bloomberg cover now, according to Huffington Post, according to what Isaac just sent along to me, racist chic. And it is causing quite a stir out there in Blogistan, and I guess it's been talked about by a number of radio folks, which of course thrills Bloomberg Businessweek to no end, because there is no such thing as bad PR. There's either PR or no PR. But it doesn't change the nature of the inquiry. And the inquiry is not, is this country still a racist nation? The inquiry is more properly, how racist is this country? The inquiry is one of asking, have we become less or more? Or is it some sort of a swap? Have we swapped the nastiness of institutionalized racism for a sort of snarky nudge and a wink racism that pretends merely to be some sort of biting social commentary. I put this Bloomberg Businessweek cover in the same category as the Onion's tweet about the young woman from Beasts of the Southern Wild. She really is kind of a C word, remember? It's the same thing. Oh no, we were just being edgy. At least the Onion had the common decency to apologize. I somehow doubt the apology from Bloomberg Businessweek will be forthcoming. Because you see, that's not funny. There's a big difference between the racism that was parodied and made satire of in, say, Blazing Saddles, and Richard Pryor having written the script for that, and that should never be forgotten. There was biting satire. But there's a difference between that and arguing that people who merely want to not live in squalor and who are willing to gamble their very existence on being able to live in something resembling a house are somehow at fault and are wallowing in great mounds of cash that they got because of the color of their skin. Fat Tony Scalia used that term, racial entitlement, and lo and behold, a day later, you get a visual, graphic, cartoonized, and if God wanted them to have power in this country, well, he would have made them white. You see how it works? So here endeth the filibobster. The lines are open. 304-658-3333, 304-658-3333 is the number. And you're free to join in the conversation. You can also reach the program by Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, is the Skype handle. And the interweb tubes are being substandard this evening. My apologies. So jump right in. The conversation is fine. We'll take a break and see if the phones light up or if I filibobster some more. We call what we do here Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. Progressive, uncensored, free form, and driven by your ideas. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Straight. Just February 28, 2013.
If we really are in a situation where we have low snow consistently for the future, that's a whole different business model.
Climate change already affecting Rocky Mountain skiing.
Climate change is real. Across the Pacific Islands region, the frequency and intensity of climate extremes are changing.
House Democrats smack Republicans for obstructing climate action. Shell Oil calls it quits in the Arctic, for now. Fox News makes a stunning admission. Plus, finally some good news for kids in Detroit.
All of that good news and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
In America, you have a right to be stupid.
Exercising all of our rights, this is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, a rather stunning admission brought to our attention this morning by occasional Brad Blog contributor D.R. Tucker. He notes an article at Fox News which starts this way. Quote, new technological advances make it possible in the near future to engineer a coal-powered car so clean that it produces nearly no polluting emissions, including carbon dioxide.
What?
Experts tell FoxNews.com.
What? You mean they acknowledge that carbon dioxide is a polluting emission?
They apparently did. Of course, that's only on their website. It hasn't made it onto their TV yet, where they routinely poo-poo the idea that carbon dioxide is a pollutant. Oh, it's just plant food, they tell us as they breathe out quickly to show us how they're polluting. But anyway, so there's some good news. A technological breakthrough leads to a reporting breakthrough, a truth breakthrough on FoxNews.com.
We'll see how long that lasts.
You're right.
Now on to the news. While oil giant BP is on trial for the worst offshore oil spill in the nation's history down in the Gulf of Mexico, up in the Arctic, Royal Dutch Shell has decided to call it quits. For now. After spending more than $5 billion, Shell announced this week it will not drill in the Arctic this summer after a nonstop string of ridiculous, embarrassing, and expensive failures in the harsh extremes of the Arctic, including a rig grounding on an Alaskan island last month. In a statement, Shell said the company is, quote, committed to drill there again in the future. And now the Justice Department has been brought in to investigate Shell for numerous violations of environmental and safety regulations that were found by the Coast Guard. Meanwhile, the Interior Department has announced an emergency review of Arctic drilling policy and permits, but they did emphasize that the goal of the review is not whether or not they will continue to allow Arctic drilling.
Well, what's the goal?
Oh, just to see if they can improve the process.
This was the scheme. Was it not that the Coast Guard was begging the Interior Department not to approve? The Coast Guard said, if there's a spill, we can't respond to it up in the Arctic. And now it's just been plagued with one disaster after another, as if to say, oh, we told you so.
Here's something the corporate media didn't tell you this week. In the U.S. House of Representatives, House Democrats have been slamming the Republican majority for its obstruction in addressing climate change, like new representative from Hawaii, Tulsi Gabbard, who says man-made climate change is already drying out Hawaii.
Hawaii is usually thought of as a lush green paradise, but droughts have been more frequent and prolonged. For example, earlier this month, the Big Island of Hawaii was declared a natural disaster due to ongoing extreme drought conditions going back to July of 2008.
Drought is also impacting the already arid West. Northern California on Thursday officially broke the record for its all-time driest January and February in recorded history. The Northern Sierra Nevadas have seen only 2 inches of precipitation when it normally gets a foot and a half. Changes in the snow season are hitting the multi-billion dollar ski industry in the Rockies faster than predicted. PBS NewsHour reports that ski resorts are increasingly relying on expensive artificial snowmaking, and it's only going to get worse, predicts Mark Williams, snow hydrologist with the University of Colorado.
Snow accumulation starts later, and snow melt starts earlier. And that's going to have all kinds of repercussions in terms of water availability, in terms of recreation, in terms of ecosystem services, the list goes on.
Williams projects that as early as 2030, less than 20 years from now, the snow line at Aspen Mountain could move up as much as 2,400 feet from the base. It's the opposite problem in Europe, where Greece, Italy, and Britain are reeling from torrential rainfall. Two people were killed in flash flooding in Athens this week, while British farmers are quitting after two successive years of relentless flooding, with 2012 being the UK's wettest year on record. Finally, some good news.
Finally.
In the beleaguered city of Detroit, a policy to reduce lead contamination in communities is working. Levels of toxic lead in Detroit's kids have dropped 70% in less than 10 years. Lead affects children's brain development, and contamination is highest in industrial areas. Environmental Health News warns the number of children with elevated lead levels in Detroit and the Rust Belt still remain higher than the national average, but it's going in the right direction, and it shows remediation does work.
There you go again, you and your nanny state. If the kids want to eat lead, I say let them. For more on all of these stories, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help us stay on your public airwaves. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Hot diggity, hour two. About 16 minutes past the hour. This is the horn. Lines are open. But believe me, there's plenty of filibuster material too. Got an email in from our buddy Jack in Shreveport. He said, I was making a quick pass through my Twitter timeline when I saw this tweet from my local paper. It was from the sports section. From Shreveport Times. The Independence Bowl, now this is a college bowl game, don't go turning away just yet. Dang it. The Independence Bowl has a new name. The Advocare V100 Bowl. And here's the entire article, says Jack. The main point is in the first paragraph. After 37 years, change has come to Shreveport's postseason college football game. As of this press conference, this game will be known as the Advocare V100 Bowl. Advocare President and CEO Richard Wright said at a news conference Thursday afternoon at Independence Stadium. Upon announcing the name change, Wright and the bowl staff unveiled the game's new logo. A red, white, and blue football sitting atop a shield with five blue stars and the Advocare Bowl word mark. Word mark? Jack says, son of a... From a name with no institutional roots at all to a sterile, corporatized, meaningless buzzword. This caught me by surprise. Everything's for sale, Jack, and I do mean everything. Pity the poor folks. Well, not poor folks. But pity the people who attend Florida Atlantic University. This is just precious. If you want to go watch a Florida Atlantic University football game next fall, you will have to... Well, maybe not next fall, but as soon as they're done constructing it. Florida Atlantic University is getting a big, brand-new, shiny stadium. Because they play football in Florida and they take their football seriously, and somebody hopes to have a national championship down there someday. But they're getting a new stadium. And the new stadium, well, you have to sell the naming rights. For instance, when it's been a long time since I have, it used to be that when we went to football games up in Morgantown, we went to football games at Mountaineer Field. Okay, makes sense. But the naming rights were sold, and now it is Milan Puskar Stadium at Mountaineer Field, named after a wealthy donor who got rich making generic pharmaceuticals. Nothing says gridiron like generic pharmaceuticals. But I feel downright good about that as compared to the folks who are going to have to deal with what's been done at Florida Atlantic University, because Florida Atlantic University is now going to be named after one of the several private for-profit prison companies that operate in the state of Florida. I forget which one. Really? You got to figure they'll have a Jim Dandy on-site detention center, don't you? Sheesh. It's all for sale. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John in North Carolina. How you doing?
Hey, John, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Listen, I was struck by that last thing you talking about the Florida Atlantic football stadium. I'm wondering what's the deal with prisons in higher ed? Because where the school I was at last, we had a little campaign going to try to raise awareness. The furniture, the desks and the chairs and stuff in the lecture halls were we figured out were made by prison labor.
Oh, charming!
I forget the company's name, and it would be a better story if I remembered. But yeah, I mean, there's, and I would imagine it's a pretty common thing in schools, you know, nationwide, because, you know, I guess it's cheap, because, you know, it's always better when you don't have to pay your labor, I suppose, and trying to, you know, let students know, hey, you know, where you're sitting, made by prison labor. Just a strange connection. I don't get the link.
Well, if they're state universities, the link is between the fact that somebody was getting their palm greased a little higher up the food chain, I imagine.
Yeah, it's that. And I suppose it's also
because there's almost no overhead beyond materials. You certainly don't have any labor costs.
Right, but I mean part of the idea of public education and public science in general. I mean, there's a really strong trickle down effect when you fund, you know, scientific research, and when you fund, it's the same thing as infrastructure work, because, you know, you fund basic research in the sciences, and some folks in the Horn family can probably elaborate on this, but you fund basic science, and, you know, the person who gets the grant, which is public money, hires additional research scientists, and they buy materials, and, you know,
yeah,
they also maybe generate knowledge that's helpful for folks. It just seems like we're so short-sighted in trying to cut corners in education and science and research that that stuff benefits us. You know, same with infrastructure.
Yeah, it absolutely does. But but this is a country that now imprisons more of its citizens than any other developed nation on earth, and it's become an industry. And industry has to be supported at all costs. Oh, and by the way,
yeah,
the prison company, Jack tells me by email, is GEO, the GEO private for-profit prison company in Florida.
Oh, in Florida, yeah.
It's going to be the GEO Stadium.
It seems like such a conscious decision, because, you know, if you could pay, you know, why can't we support universities to the level where they can buy, you know, infrastructure, furniture, and things like that for classrooms that they source locally that would give Americans jobs, give people, you know, put folks to work. It's just, that would be a closed loop that's beneficial to everybody, as opposed to cut. Oh, we can't afford to buy American furniture or Chinese furniture, so let's get prison folks.
And can you imagine that
Republican standpoint?
And the furniture probably is marked "Made in USA" too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it makes sense from a nasty sort of right wing standpoint, but not so much from a "Hey, let's try to, you know, make our own society better" standpoint.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah. That sounds real cynical.
Well, no, it's not. Well, I mean, are we at a place in this country, John, where cynicism has merged with realism? Because that's what it feels like. I don't feel cynical anymore. I just feel realistic. When you watch Fat Tony Scalia pining for the days of Jim Crow, I mean, all questions have been answered about the right wing, have they not?
Well, I guess so, and see also, you know, comedy shows being a better source of news than the actual news. That's kind of related.
Yeah. It's well, we're going backwards. You know, we should have been on Mars by now, for God's sakes, you know, with human beings, not just robots. But instead, instead we are putting the finishing touches on the world's most brilliant imprisonment society.
Yeah. And nothing against the Mars robot. That's really pretty awesome.
It's extremely awesome.
Sure. Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, listen, I wanted to let you know about a little tiny bit of activism that's going on down here in Wilmington.
Oh, awesome.
Elaborate. Yeah, we there's a I'm with a student group here at UNC Wilmington that's sort of the ecological, you know, student association, right? And there's a big push going on right now to try to change the sourcing of the power for universities across North Carolina. It's backed by Greenpeace. The thing is, the energy that powers our campuses comes from an outfit called Duke Natural Resources, or Duke Energy.
Ew.
I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yeah. Ew.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty nasty. Big coal power company. They do a lot of nuclear work too, which is nice. I will say in their defense that they have committed to a plan to increase their renewable portfolio. By 2032, they're going to have an entire 3% of their portfolio be from renewable sources. A whole 3%, which is kind of striking to me, because if we're talking about, you know, things like peak oil and, you know, coal mining becoming less and less profitable and harder to get, that's 30 years in the future, and they're saying, oh, no, we're gonna stick with our profile like it is right now for 30 years. Yeah.
No, we can, well, you know, we can just burn our way to prosperity, can't we?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess they're going to be just, you know, making it, you know, new coal. Anyway, so this is a big push across North Carolina campuses, and we're doing our part down here. So spent some time today doing some petition work and raising awareness about mountaintop removal, because part of Duke's sort of nasty legacy is that they're real big into MTR.
Oh, yes, they are.
It's tough for me, tough for me to find out exactly how much. They're kind of cagey about it in public, but I know, having gone to Isle of Mountains and using that widget, that here in Wilmington we are directly connected to several mountaintop removal operations, and Duke is our supplier, of course.
Yeah, that and when you go there and you realize that, it's sort of shocking, isn't it? I mean, it really creates a very connected sense of just ick.
Oh yeah, because it's a great map. It shows the specific mines and where they are, and I think there's 5 MTR operations, and I think 4 of them are in West Virginia. It really ties, you know, us here into what you're talking about. It's pretty amazing.
And of course, places like Charlotte, which is a home to big banking, and Bank of America, which is shameless in its financing of mountaintop removal, has terrible air quality problems from coal-fired power plants. And I know a number of people who have gone down to Duke Energy protests and, in fact, gotten arrested in acts of civil disobedience, trying to draw attention to the horror that it is. North Carolina is one of the single largest consumers of mountaintop removal coal in the United States, in point of fact. And I guess that's kind of sort of understandable because of proximity issues.
Well, I guess it is, but we, as far as I can tell, we don't actually do that here.
No.
We're an enormous consumer, and that's a connection, I think, that resonates with folks. At least it did today in the conversations I had.
Yeah, mercifully, the portion of the Appalachians that are in North Carolina do not have coal under them.
Right.
So that means that it's, you know, Western North Carolina, places like Boone and Asheville, are able to remain beautiful, in places where people with lots of money in their pockets can go and buy nice places to live and never hear the blasting that supports the electricity that comes on when they flip the switch and walk out of the room.
They charge their golf carts. Yeah, exactly. You'd be very impressed by this. I probably talked one-on-one, you know, little conversations with maybe about 2 dozen people in an hour today, and almost to a person, they knew what mountaintop removal was. And these were undergrads. You know, I had my awesome CRMW shirt on, and several people said, you know, nice shirt. And so I always asked them, you know, do you know about this? Where did you learn about it? How do you know about it? We have a really big environmental studies department here, and I figured it was that. Almost all of them told me that they had heard about it in high school, in ecology classes. Like, apparently there's high school teachers, mostly in North Carolina, that are talking about this. And I was really struck by that. I thought that was a really pretty amazing.
That may be the best piece of good news I've had in a while, John.
Yeah, it was really striking. I was like, wow, that's wonderful. Of course, super nice to everybody and thanked them. And of course, it's a weird subset. It's a college campus and a bunch of undergrads and folks who are pretty focused on this sort of thing, really happy to sign petitions. You know, that's nice. But really the amount of awareness that I found was very striking to me. I thought it was good, you know.
And of course, from my biased standpoint, John, the next question is, did they know that there are very real efforts out there to end it?
They did when they were finished talking to me. I gave them little cards that said HR 526 and CRMW.org on the back, and I said, you know, go to this site, call your representative, because this is a real effort to stop this, and we need support.
And you know, there are people in North Carolina who should be amenable to this that we just haven't had a lot of luck with yet. Granted, he does a few things that I'm not necessarily in agreement with, like, for instance, voting against the Violence Against Women Act. But, you know, Walter Jones, who recently said that he expects Dick Cheney to burn in hell, you would think that we could reach him with this.
Well,
because what's happening to, you know, to babies in the womb, and he cares about babies in the womb.
He does, and I'll tell you, he's my guy, and I am attempting to contact him, and so far I've had very little luck. But he's not as good as he looks on paper.
No, and he's a complete. Yeah, he's got a lot of military bases in his district, does he not?
He does. Yeah,
he is generally a four square military industrial complex kind of guy.
Yeah,
but there are other people who should be reachable. Now, I don't expect to be paying any calls to Virginia XX Fox anytime soon. I think she probably would be happy to eat coal sludge on her Wheaties in the morning. Well, no, she wouldn't. She knows it's poisonous. It's just okay to poison us, and as long as we're, but even her constituents are breathing the stuff.
Yeah.
And the problem in North Carolina is profound, and there's been a lot of education work done down there through some other organizations. And, you know, the awareness is there. The question is, what next? You know, what do you do? And as far as I can tell, the only thing that's out there that is a viable end to it, John, is the AIC Act. And what folks can do simply by going to AICAC.org and using the widget to send a message to their member of Congress or their senators.
I think you're absolutely right, and I don't mean to sort of toot my horn here. I mean, this is like the very bare minimum somebody could do. But I think it's one thing to say, you know, all the North Carolina system presidents are going to get these petitions from their students and say, you know, we want you to bring these to the chancellor. We want you to talk to Duke and say that, you know, there's a lot of support for you guys to change your energy profile. Okay, that's one thing, you know, but that's not really going to do much. I think the more powerful thing, the more profound thing, is just this fact of outreach and talking to people and saying, look, there's this issue here, and it's bad, and here's why, and it's affecting you, and you need to be aware of it, and here's something you could do. What you do with it is up to you. I think that's a potentially more profound sort of consciousness-raising sort of thing, and I was really happy to sort of...
Absolutely, because it's got solutions attached to it.
Yeah,
it's one because if you just know what's going on and then nothing follows from it, it's one of those faith without works is dead kind of situations, isn't it?
Well, even worse, it leads to just, you know, nihilism and despair. I mean, when you know a terrible thing is happening and you do nothing about it, that hurts you on the soul level. But when you do any sort of action to work towards it, it's uplifting, and it just on a basic personal level, you feel better.
You know, as I've gotten older, John, I've found more and more, I've given more and more weight to the idea of it is important to be able to look and say, I tried to do something. Yeah. I tried to accomplish something. When called upon, I didn't necessarily go along with the status quo. I tried to make things change for the better. And that's, you know, that's the difference between us and the Horn Commune, and say, you know, a Scalia. You know, he wants to go backwards to the good old days of Jim Crow. And I'm sure he would, you know, I'm sure he finds the idea of so-called environmentalism utterly repugnant, because he has a mindset set that says he was put on this planet to consume as much as he possibly may. And I don't understand that mindset. I can't participate in it. And so the fact that you were out the door with your Cold River Mountain Watch T-shirt on, and out there doing what I call missionary work, I think that's just beautiful. And unless I'm severely mistaken, you came away from it feeling uplifted, did you not?
Oh, I'm going to be there every week. Yeah, we're going to do it till it's done, you know, and then keep doing it. It feels great. It's a wonderful feeling. And yeah, you know, to be able to say, I did this one thing. Change doesn't happen because one person does one thing. You know, it happens through group action, through constant agitation. You know, it's not a great man theory of history. You know, think about what Margaret Mead said, you know, groups of people can affect change, you know.
Yes.
And
Didn't she say, in fact, it's the only thing that has ever worked?
Yeah, it's the only thing that ever has. And I would say just, if Scalia is against it, that means I'm pretty much for it, I would suggest. So that's a good touchstone for me.
Right. He's a big walking fascist barometer. So when you talk to these students, John, did you get a sense that having been empowered, that they feel empowered to go and be brave and talk about it openly and try to get more people involved?
I sure hope so. I think it's going to take, you know, several contacts. You know, we have to hit the same people over and over again and just keep a presence. You know, any sort of group like this. I mean, I have so much respect for the people who, you know, day in and day out, week in and week out, stood up against the Iraq War. You know, people like Jude, you know, here in the commune. It's not that seeing or talking to somebody once will necessarily change minds or empower people, but constantly seeing it over and over again, you know, that affects people on a deep level. So this kind of thing has to keep happening. And unfortunately, it's not an easy change, as you know, because you've been working how long on this. And like Chairman Wiggins said in your interview last night, he said, you know, we may be fighting this 100 years from now, but we're going to keep doing it. And you kind of have to take that long look, because if something's worth fighting for, it's worth fighting over and over for, you know?
Exactly. And if you understand it, well, part of it is transitioning past the American consumerist instant gratification syndrome, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah, I don't want to win unless I can win right now.
Yeah.
Well, there's right now has a very, very different meaning depending on where you're looking at it from. The thing, you know, the one of the things that I find so inspiring about what the Bad River Band is doing is they're trying to stop it before it gets started. Because I have some significant dark nights of the soul, and have had conversations with allies and colleagues who have confirmed that, you know, it's not just me. You really, really do have to wonder what's gonna be left to save in a region like this. Yeah, how many generations is it going to take before the children stop being sick, before the birth defects begin to abate, before the cancer and heart disease rates go back down, before those excess deaths trend downward instead of continuing to climb upward. It's scary. And so when you think about passing the struggle on to your kids or your grandkids or whatever, it is daunting. And so, you know, the determination to never see the first blast go off in the Pinoki Hills is, well, it's inspiring in ways that are almost difficult to verbalize.
No doubt. No question at all. The only thing I would say is that that doesn't mean that it's not worth contesting now, because, you know, we whenever a generation arrives, they inherit a past that's already given to them, you know, the conditions that they're born into. And without agitation, without struggle, the conditions they inherit will be worse. It'll be harder for them. So incremental work, even if it is incremental work now, benefits the future, if that makes sort of any sense.
No, it makes an abundance of it, John.
Yeah.
It truly does. Well, when you do when you do go back next to the meetings, please convey to them the thanks from at least one hillbilly, and probably a lot more, and tell them we've got their back.
You got it. Thanks a lot. It's good talking to you. I'll get out of your way here.
All right. Thanks, John. Have a great evening.
All right. Take care. Bye.
All right, bye now. Dr. John calling from North Carolina, out there doing a little bit of on-campus missionary work, because it is. That's exactly what it is. You don't have to be able to, you don't have to be going around telling people about talking snakes to try to bring people to an understanding of, and I use this word advisedly, salvation. Because at this point, climate change and the effort to deal with it is a matter of the salvation of the future of humanity. I've got a story here, and you know, it naturally comes out of the old Confederacy. It comes out of the state that started the Civil War, naturally. Every now and then, governments, even in places like South Carolina, stand, make a passing attempt at understanding what is happening in their world. This comes from the Herald Online, serving York, Chester, and Lancaster counties. Dateline is Columbia, South Carolina. There's a bit of a stink cooking down in South Carolina, because it turns out that the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, in an attempt to actually do its job, produced a report of some 108 pages. Or maybe 102. 102 pages. And that 102-page report, and you have to tell how many pages, because Republicans are always concerned. Have you read it? There's 1,000-page. Well, Fat Tony Scalia, you really expect me to read all this? Well, you know, we do. You have been cashing the paychecks, Tony. This 102-page report details what may be expected from the continuing onset and expansion of climate change for a state like South Carolina. You know, a big part of South Carolina is referred to as the Low Country. And it's not a reference, it's not a character aspersion. It is low as in not very high above the seawater. Which means that with climate change and rising sea levels, we can kind of expect the Low Country to go away. And it'll be the underwater country. So this 102-page report is generated last year. And what did the Republican-dominated government of the state of South Carolina do? They buried it in a deep, deep, deep hole out behind the state, out behind Nikki Haley's house sometime last year. Unfortunately, in a moment of what can only be called unrestrained journalism, this newspaper apparently got hold of the report. And you can see why Republicans would not want it to see the light of day. Here are some of the details, the findings of the Department of Natural Resources. And by the way, the Republican government of South Carolina said, it ain't really such a big deal. It ain't a big deal at all. And the only reason we didn't release it is because it still needs some tweaking. By tweaking, we mean removing all negative references to climate change. By tweaking, we probably mean destroying. And that dog ate it. Old Blue, he gets rambunctious now and then, and he ate up that climate change report. Well, it ain't no such thing as climate change. But here's some of the findings. Climate change in South Carolina will deplete food sources for young fish, as plankton needed by developing marine life might not bloom at the time when some sea creatures need to feed on it. Heat beach sand enough to reduce the population of male loggerhead sea turtles, which would hurt reproduction. Turtles hatching in hot sand tend to be mostly female. Cause more dead zones in the ocean, stretches where oxygen levels drop sharply, making it hard for marine life to survive. Worsen droughts that kill marsh grasses, which provide shelter for young fish, crabs, and other marine life. Push salt water further into coastal rivers, killing off or depleting some species of fish and potentially affecting drinking water supplies. That actually affects humans. Actually, all of this affects humans, but don't tell the Republicans. Sea levels could rise as much as 2 feet in the next century. 2 feet of sea level rise in 100 years. Let's just say some of that expensive property on Kiowa Island is going to need a gondola and a gondolier singing O Solo Mio to get from... the cocktail parties just ain't going to be the same. Increase flooding on beaches and marshes. Increase diseases that affect shrimp. You think about things like that, well, it goes away. It does indeed. And I realize, it's been a tough night for the interweb tubes here. So at least we'll have a good clean recording. Okay. In my real time, that was about 4 minutes. In yours, it was almost instantaneous. Welcome back to the Horn. You just missed a wonderful conversation with Jim. And you probably missed also part of the conversation with Dr. John. Deeply frustrating. but I just told Ben Birch that I will put the podcast file up in two pieces. So it will go up hopefully shortly after the program finishes. This being Thorn in the Side Thursday, let's take a look at, we started out talking about Fat Tony Scalia because that was, it was just, burr under my saddle. But there's other stuff in the rest of the world. Silliness, meanness. In the course of the conversation with Jim, I mentioned remarks made by Representative Bob Goodlatte of Virginia. And under normal circumstances, Supreme Court Justice who says that voting is some sort of a reverse discriminatory racial entitlement. I guess it's not so surprising when you find Representative Bob Goodlatte talking about immigrant labor and admitting, if you get in terms of an immigration bill, admitting if you give them legal status, they can work anywhere in the United States. They're not going to necessarily work at the hardest, toughest, dirtiest jobs. Because we can't have any white folks doing them hard, tough, dirty jobs. That's why God made Mexicans. Right? And that is so discordant to the ear for me even to say. But that's reality. That's reality in the right wing. Their version of capitalism cannot exist without some degree of bond servitude undergirding it. I mean, if undocumented immigrants have legal status, well, they can work anywhere in the United States. I mean, they might actually earn a decent living. They might actually participate in the American dream. And we can't have that. Jesus. I wish I was surprised. I am, unfortunately, not. And then a little story from a few days ago that just bothered me no end. Because it is so freighted with all the nasty, dirty, paternalistic, racist, classist bigotry out there proudly on parade. If you know anything about the British crown jewels, you know that the jewel that tops the crown, worn not by the monarch, him or herself, but by their consort, the jewel that tops that crown is called the Koh-i-Noor diamond. It's a giant diamond. It is 105 carats. The British stole it from India and tucked it into the crown. And, for instance, should the woman who married the prince who is presently second in line under primogeniture to the throne of the UK, should he become king and she, his being his wife, be his consort, that crown would be placed upon her head. And if you want to talk about a blood diamond, the Koh-i-Noor diamond is, in fact, the bloodiest of blood diamonds. It goes back to colonial India. And it goes back to bloodshed and pillage. The British forced India to turn over the diamond, to give it to the royal family back in the colonial era when Britain ruled India with an iron fist. A number of Indian people, free now of England, would like to have it back. You know, mainly because it's theirs. And so last week, British Prime Minister David Cameron visited India and expressed regret for the massacre in Amritsar in 1919. But when asked about the Koh-i-Noor diamond, he said, "Oh no, we'll not be giving that back." It's the same question with the Elgin marbles. I don't think that's the right approach. The right answer is for the British Museum and other cultural institutions to do exactly what they do, which is to link up with other institutions around the world to make sure that the things which we have and look after so well are properly shared with people around the world. I certainly don't believe in returnism, as it were. I don't think that's sensible. The Governor General of India compelled the diamond to be presented to Queen Victoria in 1850. You know, yes, you're going to give this to the Queen. We'll blow your freaking brains out. She'll love it. Greece wants the Elgin marbles back, too, because they were stolen. And this is a deep question for some. What are the rights of pillaged peoples to that which was pillaged away from them in a more brutal, arguably, more brutal time? I'm sure the British Museum does do a good job conserving. But that is not the inquiry in question. The question is, does the Crown have any right to hang on to something that, like it or not, it's pretty plain that they stole? Now, what's the other side of this coin? Well, it's a form of paternalism, I was talking about with Jim. It is a paternalism that says that people cannot be trusted with their own patrimony. Matrimony? Heritage. Yeah, maybe. Let's just get the gender all the way out of it. That non-white people cannot be trusted with their own heritage. Believe you me, if it was possible to move the pyramids, they would not still be sitting in Egypt. Would they? I doubt it. Marty, with a good point. When the Spanish, Portuguese, Italians return the gold and jewels that they stole from the native people in South America, I'll care about a crown jewel. Sorry. No, I understand, Marty. But it's all of a piece. It's all part of the same process and the same mindset. But the people of India deserve to have that rock sent back to them because it's theirs. And when David Cameron, right winger that he is, says that the British Museum will continue to do what it does, an excellent job of conservation and sharing with the world. Well, what he is tacitly saying is that, well, those people can't be trusted. This is important to the world now. And we, the vestigial remainder of the British Empire, we are the only ones who can be trusted with their heritage. Kind of sickening, isn't it? Be interested to get Dr. John's take on this. This is really his field of expertise. That royal family that could start spending millions of dollars a day of its own money today and never go broke is so tight, so avaricious, that it cannot even give up one thing that it stole 150, 163 years ago. Kind of points out how graspy they are, doesn't it? I don't support returnism. Returnism, as if it was something silly for people to want their damned heritage back. I don't know if anybody's even listening at this point. We've had so many problems with the interweb tubes this evening. It's about 19 minutes before the hour. If you've got something on your mind, you are certainly welcome to chime in. The number, of course, 304-658-3333. Or via Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. No small amount of stuff to be considered. Here's another one of those paternalistic moments for this Thorn in the Side Thursday. Reverend former Governor Mike Huckabee of Arkansas. Recently said, making a keynote speech at the Republican Party of Iowa's Celebrate Life event this past Saturday, he did something that these right-wing life goobers, womb fascists, fetus fetishists, he did something that they do, they constantly refer to it in these terms. So let's hear it from his own mouth.
Schindler's List and the survivors, the Schindler Jews, walk and they place a stone on a grave. Well, that's where it was filmed, at his gravesite. He's buried in Jerusalem. I want you to think about this for a moment. Here is a person who was a member of the Nazi Party. He was, by anybody's definition, a scoundrel and a notorious sinner. He cheated on his wife. He was a heavy drinker. He used people for his own gain, and in fact, one of the ways that he made his fortune was that he would exploit the labor force that he could get from among the Jewish people who had to work for free, virtually as slave labor, and then he made pots and pans and other metal goods for the Nazis. And by ingratiating himself with the Nazis, he got the contracts for all of those particular manufacturing. It's not that unlike what goes on in Washington today. People,
wait, stop. Did you hear the little right-wingers laughing at the comparison between Washington, D.C. and Nazis? But this goes on for 9 minutes and 16 seconds. Not going to play it all for you.
Grease the palms of the politicians, who in turn then grease back the palms of those who are the donors and the financiers. So here's a guy who is, in every way, the kind of person that if he walked into Point of Grace Church, it would have been a scandalous moment. People would have looked around and said, do you know who's here? Oscar Schindler. That womanizing, heavy drinking, lying, cheating, filthy rascal. He really wouldn't have been very welcome in the typical church. And people would wonder, why was he there? And yet, there came a point in his life when he realized that the only thing standing between him and the murder of thousands of Jews who had worked for him was his intervention with the money that had been his God. And one by one, he began to literally purchase their lives. And he purchased 1,200 lives. And he saved those 1,200 people who have now had tens of thousands of descendants. The Jews have an expression, he who saves a life saves the whole world.
I sometimes think that Mike Huckabee trying to talk about the Holocaust is vomit-inducing. Because, see, he's gone to great pains to discuss Oscar Schindler. And in a minute, he is going to get up and ride Oscar Schindler's back and the 1,200 people he saved backs for his own filthy political social goals. It don't get much more disgusting. I'm not going to run the audio anymore. I don't need to be muting the mic to heave. In a few minutes more of that recording, you would have heard him say that this country needs needs people like Oscar Schindler willing, quote, to intervene on behalf of human life. And now we are called into this incredible holocaust of our own in America. 55 million babies. 55 million babies since 1973 have died in what ought to be the safest place in the world, their mother's womb. Jesus. It has become one of the most dangerous places for a baby to be. Well, there might be some truth to that, but you know what? It's dangerous for want of health care. It is dangerous for want of access to reproductive health care. It's dangerous because his own godforsaken party assaults organizations that take care of women's health care needs, like Planned Parenthood. Here's what we've told the generation coming after us, he continued. The generation of my children and now my grandchildren. Yes, his children, including the son who beat a dog to death as it hanged from a tree. We've told them that if they were expendable at that end of the spectrum of life because they just were going to be too expensive or because they represented it for us having to mess up our calendars, then we have now told them that at the other end of the spectrum of life, when they become our caretakers, we've already given them permission. In fact, we have given them full rights to end our lives. And you know what, Mike Huckabee? I hope that psychopathic son of yours puts a pillow over your godforsaken head and smothers you. Because, baby, you've got it coming. How dare this walking incarnation of the worst human filth on the planet, how dare he compare a woman's choice about the workings of her own body to the deliberate slaughter of millions upon millions of human beings who simply were born Jewish or gay or transgendered or differently abled. How dare he? How dare he? And it really would be nice if Abe Foxman would take notice of this kind of stuff and tell these filthy right-wing religious fundamentalists to stop riding the backs of 6 million dead. God almighty, if it's not weird-ass Willard Romney and his weird-ass bunch baptizing dead Jews and turning them into Mormons on Kolob, then it's Mike Huckabee out there doing the fundy shuckin' jive to claim that a woman's body is a dangerous place for a baby. A fetus, really? There are no or next to no actual babies being aborted in this country, and yet Talibandiana, wasn't it? That wanted a woman who merely took a pill to get a transvaginal probe shoved up her once before and once after. But, you know, now the moderating forces have taken over, and they're only gonna force her to be medically raped once. There are monsters that walk among us, and the name of one of them is Mike Huckabee. So, just the next time you hear Holocaust, in connection to a woman's right to manage the workings of her own body, work up a little bit of outrage. Work up a good old-fashioned give-a-damn accompanied by a how-dare-you. Because it's not just Mike Huckabee that uses this filthy meme. It's all kinds of useful idiots of the anti-rights, anti-choice brigade. Honest to God, it's fighting words. Were I Jewish, and had I relatives who had perished in the Holocaust, I would not be able to contain myself if some anti-choice freak got up and rode the back of my dead. I would not be responsible for my actions. Jesus. More internet problems. Let's see, though, if we've still got Fritz with us. Are you there, Fritz?
Yes. You hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Well, Arkansas, it's now the law of the land. The 20-week ban just went into effect today, thanks to a House override and then a Senate override. So we're becoming East Oklahoma very quickly.
So now you get to spend a lot. They get to spend a lot of money defending the indefensible in court, right?
Yes, not this one bill that's now law, but this other one's down the pike too. This 12-week bill. It had some revisions made to it, and it will go through the Senate. It'll likely be passed. You know, the override, it'll likely be, it has not been vetoed yet. It will go to the go to the governor, and he'll veto it, and then they'll shove it down the governor's throat with just a simple majority. Now this second one is 12 weeks with the mandated vaginal probe.
It just beats the daylights out of me, Fritz. The level of stupidity that attaches to all of this. I mean, that for a moment there, it was like you stopped speaking English. It was so incomprehensible to me. And I'm not talking about the way you talk. I'm talking about the content. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying?
I tell you, Bob, this is just outrageous what's happened since the Republicans took over the Arkansas legislature. It's become it's a fucking madhouse. That's all I can say about it.
It's a zoo. It's a trip to the monkey house, and the poo flinging is in full flower.
Yeah, and this legislature, today I seen where the legislature, they're going to extend the session through April. So, no telling what else is going to come down the pike here between now and April 17th.
Strap in and hang on tight, Fritz.
It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Yeah, and no sign of paved road anywhere in the offing.
No, it's more a paved road. It's more being more like a dirt trail.
Damn.
Anyway, I'll leave that with you tonight. You take care now.
I appreciate it, Fritz. I finally got the stream to come back, so hallelujah and praise Jeebus for at least that. Thanks, Fritz. This has been a deeply frustrating evening, to say the least. That razor's edge of technology upon which we dance so delicately has cut my heels to ribbon tonight. And it's kind of frustrating also because, well, this was the last night of February, and we had some fundraising to do, about $200 worth, to get us to where we were going. We ain't going to make it. We will keep plugging away, though. And thanks to all of you who made sure that February happened. Thank you. And we'll do our damnedest in March. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to Agnes for help with the post. Thanks to John Fox. Thanks to Ben Birch, who has been communicating with me steadily throughout this nightmare this evening. WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. And Rick Smith is next on The Horn.